In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Here in Canada, there's some optimism about where the numbers are right now as much of the country continues to reopen.
Confidence in BC, where case numbers are much lower.
Small social gatherings with physical distancing will be allowed.
In Montreal, the country's COVID-19 epicenter, daycares are open.
We have almost half of the elementary school open.
In Ottawa, patio season finally is just days away.
Today is a big day for the reopening in the province of Saskatchewan. Many that have been unable to work over the last number of weeks will now have an opportunity to do so.
As I sit down and record this, my province has just announced its lowest COVID-19 case count in 2 months. In Ontario, much of the province is moving to phase 2 of reopening, and other provinces are well ahead of us. Obviously, I really hope that I'm not jinxing it by saying this, but Canada is slowly emerging from our long isolated hibernation. And we should be jubilant. I mean, this is just in time for a real summer, full of patios and gatherings and even a haircut. So why do some of us feel so anxious about it? What has the past 3 months done to our brains? How have our feelings about risk adapted to what was a new normal, and how will they shift back? Why are some people eager to join their friends in the park and others still wary about a trip to the corner store? How has Canada coped with our long collective bout of anxiety, and what's going to remain in the backs of our minds long after this virus goes away? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Judith Law is the executive director of Anxiety Canada, and it's been a busy few months for anxiety. Hi, Judith.
Hello.
Why don't you start by telling me what it's been like since the beginning of the pandemic? What has this year in general done to anxiety in Canadians?
Great question. I would say that, firstly, since about March, we have, as an organization, been really on our toes. It has been nonstop. So we're hearing from Canadians, actually North Americans. Anxiety is ever present in our lives. And March, when, you know, measures started to be put in place across Canada, was very much the start of the peak of heightened anxiety across the country. And we saw and heard from Canadians that the level of uncertainty was at times intolerable. Yeah.
How does that work over time? So it peaked in March, and you mentioned it was the start of that peak. How long did you guys see that peak last? And how do people adjust to such a strange new world? And does that anxiety sort of drop off over time?
What we experienced is really a solid 8 weeks of people just feeling that they weren't sure what they would be hit with next. I think ordinary people who, we all have anxiety, it is, you know, it's what protects us. But we were very much feeling it in the background and in the forefront. So we were unsure of our personal safety. We were unsure that if we were perhaps asymptomatic and perhaps passing on the virus to someone else, someone we love, there really has been a lot that people have had to grapple with because measures were evolving and we were glued to the news. So that was, on the one hand, reassuring, because that's what we do when we're anxious. We look for reassurance. And so, you know, your aunt, your colleague at the office, everyone you know is talking about the latest stat. And you're just, you know, we were so trying to keep up because we were looking for more and more information. But that, of course, then worked against us. We became increasingly more anxious, either because we weren't getting the information that we thought we should be, or very simply, we felt that the information that we were getting, emotionally, we weren't able to cope as well. We were, yeah, it was about all about coping.
Well, can you tell me a little bit about how anxiety, especially this kind of really intense anxiety, can present really differently in different people? Because, you know, I've mentioned on this podcast before that I've struggled with health anxiety. And as this began in March, I assumed that it was going to make me an anxious wreck. But it actually turns out that having a health scare right in front of me was something that I'd basically spent my life of anxiety preparing for. And I know other people expressed similar feelings to me. And then some people who are amongst the most self-assured people I know just couldn't do anything. So what's it been like to try to work with people to navigate these different responses?
It's been, you know, all really great questions. I think what we heard was that people who had really suffered from anxiety, so, you know, every day, this mild to moderate level of anxiety that you feel, because you are someone who has struggled with it. And so for those people who are able to really become experts, so by that I mean, these are people who have studied up on anxiety. They know that the worries happen in our heads and then we feel anxiety in our bodies, and who've really on a daily basis battled this. When the virus came, for many of those who were learning about it, they were in some ways more prepared. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was hearing from people who have, for example, learned a bit about cognitive behavior therapy, which is a very effective form of psychological treatment for people with anxiety disorders and depression.
Yeah.
And then their observations were also really interesting, because what I was hearing from them was, my God, when you look around, all these people are behaving like I used to behave. Like they are, you know, panic shopping because they're worried that they're going to run low. There's so much irrational behavior. People wanting to feel a lot safer and doing things that might help them in the short run, but is going to really harm them in the long run if they continue behaving this way. So yeah, what you said is true. There was a range. So you had people who normally were, you know, quite social, but suddenly they go into lockdown mode. I mean, that's why so many people were telling us, for one, we're working from home. The kids, of course, are home with us. We're ordering all our groceries into the home. We haven't stepped out in, you know, 10 days. Mm-hmm. So that sort of really self-imposed quarantine, when perhaps the measures in that province didn't require that, but they as a family unit felt they really had to go into a form of lockdown. While others who had, as I said earlier, lived with anxiety all their lives were able to use some of what they had learned to manage on a daily basis.
So you mentioned that the peak that you saw lasted about 8 weeks. What happened after that? Do we normalize these type of conditions? Does it just become part of our regular lives?
We are such resilient creatures. So not sure that normalizing is the word that I would use, but I say that tolerating uncertainty is what we've increasingly been required to do, and it is what we're doing. And we've seen that there are changes in terms of what the, you know, for example, during the beginning of the pandemic, we were asked if we had personal protective equipment to share that. There were lots of collections throughout Canada. We were, you know, masks were reserved mostly for healthcare workers, for first responders. And then, of course, that's evolved because our chief medical officers have learned about more about the virus, how it spreads. We're still learning. But, you know, suddenly when you go out now, people are wearing masks that they've made or bought. And, you know, we've been told that this is an added layer of protection. So I think that that's another piece where, with all the uncertainty, we've been tolerating and coping. And ways that we've been coping have been to isolate ourselves, to seek reassurance. So we're avoiding situations, we're avoiding people, we're looking for more information. And in the short term, that has helped us to feel a bit better, although they're not necessarily healthy things to be doing for long periods of time.
Well, that brings me to the question that really interests me and one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you, which is that now that most provinces have either opened up mostly or like us in Ontario here are moving into phase two where, you know, some restaurants are expected to open and et cetera, this is probably the most anxious I've felt as, you know, it starts to become expected that we'll go back to taking public transit and be going into office buildings. And I know none of that is happening right now, but talk to me a little bit about what kind of things are going on in the minds of folks who should be excited that things might be getting back to normal, but instead are worried.
Right. We've certainly talked to a lot of workers. So people who are, say, Vancouver is a good example right now. The city is still looking very much like a ghost town. Many of us have gone back to work, and that's been tough because people are worried about riding transit to get to the office. We are worried about the measures that have put in place for physical distancing. So does that, you know, how is that going to work? Does, you know, if I need to go to the washroom, I know that our washroom's pretty small. So does that mean that, you know, we're going to queue for the washroom? How am I going to take my breaks? Because will there still be a lunchroom? So all these practicalities have come into play, and people, you are worried. And then there is the fear of bringing that back into your home. And it's been really tough because there's more uncertainty, there's more change. And what we're also hearing is that people who are, say your grocery store clerks, people who really are every day engaging with a lot more people. And so they feel the probability of them catching the virus is higher. And same with dentists. Recently heard from my dentist who sent an email, and as are the paramedicals. So they, you know, there's a long list of things that you have to read. Then you've got to fill out the COVID assessment. And then they call you the day before. So there are measures that are being put in place. And interestingly, they're measures that are to keep us safe. But how we might react is really just with a bit of fatigue and irritability that, gosh, this thing, it just hasn't gone away. You know, the pandemic is still here with us and we're still having to pivot and adapt. And how long is this going to take? So I think it's a combination of things. There's impatience, right? And yet we know that based on recent surveys, something like 75% of Canadians really support health measures that are being that have been put in place and that are evolving. We really support it. But we also 88% of us in a recent survey in, that went from April to May experience at least one symptom of anxiety. And there's high anxiety for those of us who aren't working. So that's that other piece too that I should say is that there are people looking for work, right? And they still have financial obligations while they're looking for work or while they're accepting the CERB from our federal government. So really, really tough. There's that opening up, those lucky people get to go back to work. There's fear for the, you know, that these, that we experience as those who are still working about our personal safety, about the safety of loved ones, about all the changes we're having to make still. And then, of course, there are those who are currently unemployed.
What do we know about the long-term impacts of this? I mean, we've been really lucky just as a country in general that Canada has not faced any real sort of collective disaster, collective trauma for years, and everybody now is grappling with. And I don't say this jokingly at all, but are we going to all end up with like collective PTSD when this is hopefully finally over? Like, what do we know about the lasting impact?
We don't know a lot, but we certainly know that the pandemic, yeah, is affecting a lot of people adversely. And in particular, it is adversely affecting those who are on the front lines and having to make really difficult decisions. It's also affecting family members because so many have passed away during COVID-19 and we weren't able to say goodbye in person. Perhaps we weren't able to say goodbye at all to our loved ones. So there's a sense of grief and loss, a great sense of that. There are also those who are graduating this year from high school or reaching another milestone and they were expecting to be celebrating. And instead, during this time of, really since March, they've had to make do. And that making do has been extremely unfair and difficult. This period will, I would say, for all of us who are going through this, some more than others, will certainly be memorable. I think that we underestimate, and this is the thing about anxiety and human beings, is that we have a tendency to overestimate the probability of bad things continuing or going wrong. And then we also underestimate our ability to manage and to deal with these bad things, so-called bad things, and also to manage uncertainty. I'm always a glass half full person. And in the anxiety world, we really want to help people by having them understand what they're feeling is real. Absolutely. This is unprecedented. And then to focus on the things that they actually have, that we actually have control over, which is still quite a bit. So I would say that there is trauma. It isn't over yet. We're not sure what's on the horizon. And certainly for those who have had to make very difficult decisions these past few months, it's very likely that a lot of people will seek help.
What kind of resources are available, have been made available or will be from provincial and the federal governments? Have we seen a renewed investing in mental health, given that it seems like we're going to need it down the line?
I think that the federal government has really stepped up to support businesses, so to support Canadians so that they can stay in their jobs and they can also, if they've lost their jobs, that they're receiving support. And financial support is so important. It is actually critical to people feeling that they are empowered to meet their obligations and that they've got some certainty. So that's a big piece that I think the federal government's done a really good job of rolling out. mental health continues to be underfunded. What we've seen is the government has announced support for certain organizations, such as, you know, telephone support, so that you're getting some coaching. Provinces like BC have created or funded an app that young people, post-secondary and high school kids can access. And these are all helpful. I think what's really missing is that, in a way, it's surprising to me, but is there isn't a lot of, I'll just say, depth. They're not understanding that there is a spectrum and that people are going to really need some psychological treatment. We don't know what the percentages are, but what you want is to teach people, is to provide them with real skills that they can learn to use and that they can use for the rest of their lives. So when phase two comes, we know that these are the ways that we can help ourselves, and that if we are experiencing trauma, that we would get psychological treatment, and that can be through group treatment or one-on-one therapy. I'll just mention that we, as Anxiety Canada, we have a leading, totally free anxiety management app, and we've seen an increase, a significant increase month to month this year, of the number of people who are learning about anxiety management by using the app. So people are learning to become experts. But I think that the federal government and the provincial governments need to take this a lot more seriously. It is anxiety and mental health, as you mentioned, has always been taken the back seat to physical health. And there really is no real health without mental health.
You kind of touched on it a minute ago, but that was going to be my last question, is if I'm somebody listening to this right now and I realize that I am struggling and that, you know, this is having a real impact on my life, what are some resources that I can access right now and without, you know, digging too deep into what's already probably a depleted bank account?
Yeah, some of the resources that I recommend are available online at anxietycanada.com. And we have two courses called My Anxiety Plans. There's one for parents who can coach their kids. So first you learn about anxiety, because that's the best way you're going to be able to help yourself and also help your kids. So that is a free online course. We also have My Anxiety Plan for Adults. And right now, tens of thousands of Canadians are using these virtual courses. They log in, they learn about anxiety management strategies, everything from, you know, balancing your worries. So those are the cognitive pieces, to creating a fear ladder, to learning in the moment chill out tools. And that's also available on the MindShift CBT app, which is our free app. And I believe it is the world's leading free anxiety app. There are also stories. So often we think that we're alone when we have mental health challenges. So podcasts like this, as well as our anxiety stories, are really, really helpful. They validate what we're feeling, and they also help us to be able to have those conversations. We're so disconnected from self-care, right? It's always, oh, when things get tough, the tough get going. But I think that the self-care, so self-care means acknowledging how you're feeling, acknowledging what is happening around you, and then creating space for yourself to take breaks, to allow yourself to not be as productive as you're used to being, for example. So these are some of the ways. I think it's reaching out to what is available online, since we're still physically distancing and socially distancing. It's learning to become an anxiety expert, And then also a really simple one that our psychologists have talked about is finding a pandemic partner. So if you haven't already, it's so important that we have people around us who, even one person whom you can go to and say, hey, today I woke up, I'm just feeling really lousy. Not sure why, but just feeling, you know, this way. And that person is a safe person whom you can have a conversation with, and there's exchange. There's that humanizing engagement that we all need.
Those are fantastic tips, and thank you so much for taking the time to help ease our worries, Judith.
Most welcome. My pleasure.
Judith Law, Executive Director of Anxiety Canada. That was The Big Story. If you would like more, you know where they are, thebigstorypodcast.ca. You know where we are on Twitter, at TheBigStoryFPN. You should by now know our email address, TheBigStoryPodcast, all one word, all lowercase, at rci.rogers.com. And if you need something new to listen to, by all means, check out our brother and sister shows at FrequencyPodcastNetwork.com, including a new one. You might remember it from an interview we did last week. It's called Heaven Bent. Episode 2 was out this week, and it just gets crazier from there. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.